creates anger. People need people. Screens and chatbots are no answer. Fewer barriers, not more. More diversity, not monoculture. Here's my copyrighted bumper sticker. The opposite of progressive isn't conservative, it's regressive. There are very few conservatives among the Republicans in Congress. Also too few progressives among the Democrats. Yeah, these days when we're losing so much, holding your ground can seem like progress, but it isn't. Progress isn't just one thing, one direction. It's proactive, procreative, open. Change is seldom linear, apparent. Sometimes awareness is frighteningly sudden. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast include Dan Raphael, Doug McVeigh, Sherry Meredith, Anna Wilcox, and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Brian Bull, Suzanne Potter, and Danielle Smith. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath, on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Anna Wilcox. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our fall fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $45,000 by September 20th. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO, K-B-O-O, to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Street Roots correspondent Alex Caro to talk about her latest piece for the paper. It's called Super Who, Despite Supermajority, Oregon Democrats Struggle to Pass Priority Bills. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Hi, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk with us today. So your new piece looks at the special legislative session in Oregon and the hangups that have held important bills like the transportation package back. To start, could you give us a recap of this transportation bill? Where is it at?
Yeah, so this was introduced late in the regular session. And it was basically introduced to cover a $350 million budget gap that's facing the Oregon Department of Transportation. So it's pretty necessary funding for organizations like TriMet, but because it was introduced so late, it failed to pass the regular session. And so Governor Tina Kotek, she created this special session, which happened over Labor Day weekend, of this new bill, HB 3991, which is going to, if it's passed, increase gas tax by like 6 cents and other things like the payroll tax to, again, cover this budget gap that ODOT and organizations like TriMet are facing. And a quick note on that, the session was supposed to end Labor Day weekend, but it's actually been extended to September 29th for a final vote in the Senate. So it's just really been prolonged.
And that's because one of the Democrats in the Senate is having health troubles. Is that right?
Yeah. So Senator Chris Gorsuch, he's a Democrat and he is in the hospital currently, and he is needed to essentially pass this bill. And so Democrats are waiting for him to get better to be able to do that final vote.
You talked a little bit about the money, where it's coming from. What all is it going towards? Because, you know, the transportation package doesn't come up every year. It is kind of a big deal that's meant to, I mean, obviously fill some gaps for ODOT and TriMet that are facing pretty big cuts right now. But are there other big projects that are included in it?
So when I covered this story, I pretty heavily focused just on the cuts that TriMet is going to have to make. But it's going to go to organizations all over Oregon, right? So rural transit organizations that support different rural communities, as well as like road safety, ODOT, which is the Oregon Department of Transportation. They also help with like fire mitigation. So without this funding, we could have a gap in our fire response, things like that. And with TriMet in particular, they're already going to be making cuts, which are going to affect people in the Portland metro area. But if this bill doesn't pass, they're going to have to make like an 8% cut in bus routes, which will be one of the largest in TriMet's history. That will happen in 2027.
Democrats have a supermajority in both houses of the Oregon legislature. Why has it been so difficult to pass this key legislation?
Yeah, so that is an interesting question for me as a reporter, because I've reported on other states, and when you think of Oregon, you think it's really a progressive place, and they're probably able to pass really progressive policy. They have the 3/5 of the majority in both the House and the Senate that's needed to pass tax laws. But interestingly enough, it's been really hard in recent legislative sessions for a lot of things to get passed because of like this big partisan divide, which has kind of caused Republicans to really push back against Democratic ideals. And it seems like there's just a lack of dialogue and understanding. And that's what's led to like a really essential thing, like the transportation budget in Oregon, not being able to get passed. And we're like going to be getting into October.
You spoke to a few different representatives about how they diagnose the issues that the legislature is facing and being able to do what they're supposed to, which is pass legislation. What were some of their perspectives?
Yeah, so I talked to a Republican representative, Mark Owens, and he also made some comments on the floor during the special session. So for him, he feels like because Democrats introduced this bill so late, there wasn't really time for Republicans to react or to have kind of this bipartisan dialogue, though a bipartisan bill could be passed. And then from some of the Democratic point of view, from their floor comments, they do feel like there has been dialogue, like there are amendments that have been made to this original bill, which would sunset the payroll tax in 2 years, which is a concession so that Democrats could get Republicans on board. But it's just been a little messy.
So there's different sort of understandings or diagnoses about kind of who's to blame in this sort of gridlock. The transportation bill is going to be getting a final vote in the Senate at the end of the month. How will it impact underserved communities?
Yeah, so I think you see this big divide in the legislature, but you also see kind of a divide within Oregonians. Like, I think the cost of living has really increased, and any way of like raising that raises some red flags for Oregonians. But then on the other hand, like, a lot of people really support public transportation, and obviously we need our roads plowed, but particularly people who are low income and people that live in rural communities like really rely on things like TriMet and public transportation. For example, in a previous story for Street Roots, I interviewed a man who uses TriMet. He's a night worker, and those routes are like really in danger, so he might not even be able to like make it to work, which could really affect a lot of people who don't have the means, let's say, to own a car or don't own a car because they're trying to, you know, help the environment, things like that.
And it's not just in the metro area either. You also talk about a program in Klamath County called Veterans on the Go.
During public comment for this bill, there was a man named Adrian Mateos, and he is the general manager of a transit organization in Klamath County, and they do somewhere around 1,300 rides for veterans. And if this funding doesn't get passed, those are like the first programs, those are the first public transportation organizations that are going to get cut. And people really need to think about that, you know.
You touched on some of the public response, but what are people saying about it? I mean, I know that Republicans were really referencing that a lot of the written public comment was pretty negative about this bill.
You do hear a lot of people upset with cost of living, and they are already paying a lot of taxes, and they don't want their taxes to increase. But you hear in the public comments, you hear city workers, you hear ODOT workers, and they also are representing people in their communities, and they're not only going to lose their jobs because ODOT's going to, if this doesn't pass, ODOT will have to make, you know, cuts there, but their community members are also losing out on things like public transportation and, you know, in more rural places, getting their roads plowed, or like I said, wildfire mitigation, things like that.
There's a quote you have from Representative Confam, who's from Portland, that I like. Could you read it for me? The one about the Marionberry pie and the root canal.
She said, asking people if they want to raise their taxes is like asking them if they would prefer a Marionberry pie or a root canal. I think everyone, of course, would prefer a Marionberry pie. But this conversation is really forcing us to have a robust dialogue about what we are willing to pay for, but also conversations on who we are willing to prioritize.
The question remains here, right? Is there a bipartisan path forward? It seems that at the end of the month, the Senate will be able to hold their vote on this. But going forward into future sessions, something that, you know, most people might be able to agree on in principle, that we ought to have roads and they should be in good condition, you know, that seems like it ought to be uncontroversial. Is there a bipartisan way for Oregon legislators to be more collaborative going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think it just comes down to more dialogue. And if the Democrats could have introduced this bill a little bit sooner, it probably could have helped that. But also, I think both parties need to be willing to work together. And I think even we're seeing it more at like a national level too, but if we're just this us versus them mentality, like we're going to keep running into issues where we're unable to get policy passed for Oregonians.
Yeah, there's another line I think that you quote from Representative Paul Evans from Monmouth, where he says, "This is nobody's ideal bill, but it's also not the worst bill in history," which is to, you know, it's faint praise, but that's compromise.
Yeah, I think that it's just really gotten to the point where it is very us versus them, and you can see that in the press release that came out a few days ago about the extension of the special session. Democrats released their own, Republicans released their own, and it was very much, the Republicans' press release was very much kind of, you know, saying we're not going to let this pass, things of that nature, instead of, hey, where can we have a bipartisan pass?
What do you hope people take away from this story?
Yeah, if anything, I think if people could just see that, like when you hear something in the news or when you see something on social media, dig a little bit deeper, you know, like whether you're a Democrat, Republican, Independent, make sure you're understanding the issue from all angles and not just from like a really partisan and radicalized viewpoint.
If our listeners are interested in learning more, reading this story for themselves, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, you can buy Street Roots from a local vendor anywhere they're sold, and it will also be on Street Roots' website.
Thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. It's always fun to share.
That was Street Roots correspondent Alex Corot speaking with me about her latest piece for the paper. It's called Super Who. Despite supermajority, Oregon Democrats struggle to pass priority bills. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Research published in the journal JAMA Network Open finds that the actual ingredients in some magic mushroom edibles currently sold in retail shops don't match what's on the labels. On Zoom with me now is Richard Van Breemen, PhD. He's a professor of pharmaceutical sciences in the College of Pharmacy at Oregon State University, a founding member of the Global Hemp Innovation Center, and a principal investigator in the Linus Pauling Institute at OSU. He's also lead author of a research letter entitled Active Constituents of Psilocybin Mushroom Edibles that was published September 11th in the journal JAMA Network Open. Professor Van Breemen, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Doug.
Let's get to it. What was the question you were looking into?
We have for a long time in my laboratory studied the safety and efficacy of botanical dietary supplements. And we were contacted by a group at Rose City Laboratories and the Shimatsu Company, who is working with them, about identifying some unknown constituents of mushroom edibles, magic mushroom edibles, presumably coming from the psilocybes genus of hallucinogenic mushrooms. And so we broadened our botanical interest to include mushrooms and worked with this group to help identify what was actually in many of these products. So the group, the team, randomly selected 12 mushroom edibles marketed in convenience stores, smoke shops, and you can also find them on the internet, but we purchased them in the Portland, Oregon area. And the team at Rose City Laboratories tested them for psilocybin. Rose City Labs, our collaborator, is the only testing facility in the state of Oregon for legal medicinal studies and uses of medical psilocybin. So they found no psilocybin in these 12 products and then sent them to us to help with our additional analytical expertise, experience, and instrumentation, which complements theirs, help them identify what these constituents actually were. In some cases, there were no active constituents. They were simply gummies.
You mean just gummies like you'd, you mean just like a gummy bear?
Sugar and pectin. But other compounds were found in some of the gummies. We found a kava extract, and we're very familiar with kava as a supplement used for relieving anxiety, and it's been used in traditional medicine in the South Pacific Islands for generations. We also found an extract of cannabis, high in CBD and some other cannabinoids, in one of the gummies. But neither of these botanicals were disclosed on the labels, which makes them actually considered adulterated and fraudulent by the rules of disclosure and labeling of dietary supplements. But what was most disturbing to us was that several of the gummies contained not psilocybin, but synthetic analogs, which we term syndelics. So if you take the basic structure of a psychologically or psychoactive drug, or any kind of a drug, the skeleton, like penicillin has a certain skeleton, and you can make analogs or derivatives of them, which may be of medicinal value or maybe not. You don't know until they're tested. And so what's happening is some unscrupulous laboratories are taking the basic structure called a tryptamine structure of psilocybin and making analogs and then spiking them into things like these mushroom gummies. We found some, at least four different of syndelic compounds in these gummies, and in some cases, very high levels.
Okay, so now, and just to be clear, did any of these samples contain any actual psilocybin?
None. No psilocybin was detected in any product, despite the fact that some labels disclosed or indicated that psilocybin was present, or that psilocybe species of mushrooms were present. But we found no evidence of any mushrooms, even other species of mushrooms. We looked for musimol, which is an active ingredient of another type of mushroom, but we did not find that either.
Are any of these unlisted ingredients toxic? Well, any of the ingredients, period, really, but the stuff that's not listed, I suppose, is arguably more concerning. I mean, any of these in some way toxic?
Well, we do know that last year the Centers for Disease Control reported there were 80 emergency room visits due to the consumption of these over-the-counter mushroom edibles. Three deaths were reported last year, and they were traced back to a particular brand of product that were marketed as magic mushroom edible gummies or chocolates. But we think this is more of a widespread problem. It could be that some of these synthetic or syndelic analogs of psilocybin are quite toxic. And in some cases, we found very high levels. And since they could be extremely active at small amounts, trace amounts, a high dose could be harmful. And we just don't know until medical research carries out safety studies.
I suppose on the one hand, people could say, well, taken as directed, it wouldn't have a high dose. But if someone knew what magic mushrooms are actually supposed to do, they might try some, realize they're not really hitting any of the effects, and then have more. With the legal status, in so many ways, this question seems just, I start to question the relevance of I start to wonder about the relevance of this question anymore these days. But what is the legal status of the ingredients in these items? I mean, are the items themselves technically legal?
Well, first of all, federal guidelines for labeling dietary supplements require that the ingredients be disclosed. So one of the gummies we found to contain very high levels of caffeine. Now, caffeine is a perfectly legal compound. It can be added to products like beverages, soda, that sort of thing. But it's disclosed on the label. The fact that it wasn't disclosed makes it potentially harmful, especially to somebody who might be sensitive to it or having some other medication that could interact with it. Kava extracts are perfectly legal and sold over the counter as dietary supplements. But if somebody has an allergy to kava and avoids it and unknowingly consumes it in a gummy that doesn't list it but contains it, that could be a medical problem, but not a legal problem in the fact that kava is not banned substance, but not disclosing it on the label is a violation of Federal Trade Commission labeling rules. Now, the syndelics are illegal by state law, by federal law. They are analogs of controlled substance psilocybin and not approved for any medicinal use at this time.
So again, on the one hand, people are getting effects. If they know what magic mushrooms are like, they're getting effects that they don't recognize. There's a reason for going to an emergency room. This isn't what it's supposed to be doing.
Now, there are psilocybin analogs that are under development for proper medicinal use. And we think that there is a very important medical use of psilocybin and mushroom products today, and medical research is being carried out to test their efficacy in treating mental disorders, major depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and so forth. There seems to be great promise in these products for treating these problems. So we don't want to discourage people from doing research or using these products for medicinal purposes. We think there's a great potential. And there are drugs that are synthetic analogs of psilocybin, which I understand are under development medicinally. But consumers should not be the guinea pigs unknowingly taking these products to test their safety or efficacy.
Well, and again, if they're not getting the results that they expect, people are going to be put off by the stuff. What are some of the other policy implications of your findings?
Well, we're hoping that there will be support from all directions for analytical testing. We, of course, have for decades advocated the development of analytical methods, their application through good manufacturing practice to ensure that these products, whether they're medicines, dietary supplements, over-the-counter or by prescription, are safe and effective, contain a reproducible amount of active ingredient. The active ingredients are identified and labeled and quantified. And we do promote and support widespread application of these analytical tools. Ideally, not only medicines, but dietary supplements, we would like to see standardized to their active constituents. If the active constituents are not known, research should be carried out to identify them. When known, they should be quantified and put on the labels of these products so that prescribers, you know, medical professionals, consumers, patients can get a reproducible product and benefit from them safely.
I've been a legalization advocate for more than 40 years now, and one of the benefits of legalization, legal regulation, is that you know what's in that substance. The problem with the illicit market is not knowing what you're necessarily getting. The idea is you're supposed to, when it's legal, you're supposed to know. So this is... Again, folks, we're speaking with Dr. Richard Van Breemen, a professor of pharmaceutical sciences in the College of Pharmacy at Oregon State University and lead author of a research letter entitled Active Constituents of Psilocybin Mushroom Edibles. It was published September 11th in the journal JAMA Network Open. Dr. Breemen, what have I not yet asked that I should have?
This particular project was a collaboration between a testing lab, Rose City Labs in Oregon, which is the only state-certified lab to quantify psilocybin for medicinal use. My laboratory, which is an academic facility that is equipped with complementary high-end instrumentation. Mass spectrometers is what we use primarily, and they're high-resolution, accurate mass measurement instruments combined with liquid chromatography separations. And we have years of experience identifying natural products and quantifying them as well. So we were able to use our additional expertise and instrumentation to support the work at Rose City Labs to identify what was actually in these mushroom edibles, since it clearly did not contain psilocybin. And finally, we brought in help from the Shimadzu Scientific Instrument Company, who had the latest and the best of the analytical tools that they could contribute to support our work and confirm it. So it's a nice partnership between academics and industry.
Dr. Van Breemen, how can people keep up with your work? Does your lab have a website, social media, that kind of thing?
Well, certainly my name is fairly easy to find on the internet. So if you type Van Breemen Lab, you'll find my website. Also, if you go to Oregon State University College of Pharmacy or the Linus Pauling Institute, you'll find my website. So another resource that we have always used, and I use in my research every day, is the National Library of Medicine. They have a website called PubMed, P-U-B-M-E-D, and you could type my name in there and see a list of our papers and peer-reviewed research publications. And of course, one can type psilocybin, any other keywords, and get a very accurate search about the current medical literature and the past literature.
Do you have any closing thoughts for the listeners?
Beware of products that seem too good to be true. Buy products from trusted sources. Make sure that the labels are informative. A label that just says it makes you happy may not be the best product to buy. Look for quantitative measurements if they contain psilocybin mushrooms, how much. if they have been standardized to active constituents, how much. Look for those sort of qualitative labels and information that should help guide you to buy a product which might be healthful and reproducible.
Professor Van Breemen, thanks.
A pleasure talking with you.
That was my conversation with Dr. Richard Van Breemen, a professor of pharmaceutical sciences in the College of Pharmacy at Oregon State University and lead author of a research letter entitled Active Constituents of Psilocybin Mushroom Edibles, which was published September 11th in the journal JAMA Network Open. Reporting for KABU News, I'm Doug McVeigh. Coming this Monday at 2 p.m., the Monday Sampler presents part 3 of Ian Fleming's Goldfinger.
They've all gone, Mr. Bond. I will tell you the truth, because you'll have no opportunity of passing it on. My mint.